Today we're talking with a leader of NASA's Mission Control. Yeah, he ran Mission Control, and he's our guest today on the Remarkable Leadership Podcast.
Welcome to the Remarkable Leadership Podcast. We're here each week to talk about leadership, teamwork, organizational culture, and human potential with experts from every walk of life. Your host is Kevin Eikenberry, a best-selling author and leadership thought leader for nearly 25 years. If you like this show, you will love our free video course, 13 Days to Remarkable Leadership. You can learn more and sign up for at remarkablepodcast.com/13 days. And now, here's your host, Kevin.
Welcome, everyone, to episode number 80 of the Remarkable Leadership Podcast. Today, our guest is Paul Hill. You're going to love this episode, everyone. Paul Hill is a leadership evangelist, an author, public speaker, and executive consultant focusing on universal leadership challenges like risk management, critical thinking, and leading change. As NASA's Director of Mission Operations from 2007 to 2014, he was responsible for all aspects of human spaceflight mission planning, training, and mission control. In this role, Paul led critical leadership transformation, dramatically reduced cost, and increased capacity, all while conducting highly successful missions in space. So if you all think you have a hard job, just say it. Okay, before this, he held a number of senior leadership positions at NASA, including Deputy Manager of the Extravehicular Activity Office. I can't even say this stuff, Paul. The Manager of Shuttle Operations and Deputy Director of Mission Operations. He served as a Space Shuttle and International Space Station Flight Director, leading flight preparation and execution from Mission Control for 24 missions from 1996 to 2005, with his final assignment as the lead flight director for the return to flight after the Columbia accident. Prior to NASA, he was in the U.S. He was an Air Force captain and satellite operations officer. Paul, welcome. Glad to have you. I'm glad to have you. And I didn't include this in the bio, but for some of you, this will either make you happy or not. He's a proud Texas Aggie. He's got two daughters that are Aggies. He lives in League City, Texas. And Paul, I even know where that is. How about that? Listen.
Two daughters, fourth generation Aggies.
I didn't have that in all of my stalking, but fourth generation, that's pretty good stuff. So listen. You have written a book about what you learned in Mission Control, and the book is called Leadership from the Mission Control Room to the Boardroom, and we're going to talk about all of that in a minute. But after that intro and after people get a little sense of what your background is, tell us a little bit about how you got to NASA and how you got yourself to that place, because I'm sure everyone is fascinated by that. They probably never talked to someone who worked in Mission Control, let alone ran it. So can you just talk a little bit, give us the backstory just a little bit?
Sure. I mean, if you go way back, I started out as a child, as Steve Martin would say. Maybe that was Bill Cosby. But
we've watched the same movies, Paul.
Yeah. When I was a kid, my dad was an engineer at the Cape in Florida when they were first building the pads, first building the big vehicular assembly building, the great big iconic building. And I thought everybody's dad worked for NASA. And so, NASA just ran through our blood, me and my older brother. And we learned to count backwards from 10 to 0 before we learned to count forwards. And that's a real story. Most people think I make that up. So I always expected to come work at NASA. Now, fast forward, I go to college, go to aerospace engineering. I get into the Air Force doing satellite operations. Once I got there, loved the Air Force, was going to stay there. But, life has a way of going in paths you didn't plan. Yeah. And so as I was leaving the Air Force, my dad says, look, son, if you're going to come to NASA anywhere, go to Houston, go work in Mission Control. That's Operation Head Start. All the guys that grow up and become anybody go through Mission Control. And so armed with about that much knowledge, I go to Houston and luck into this job, not knowing nearly enough about what I was applying to, and right away found myself assigned in a Mission Control organization that was planning the first steps for building the space station in orbit. And, I was learning as I went. What I knew how to do is I knew engineering, and from my time in the Air Force, I knew how to have initiative, take charge, get things done. But then my peers had to teach me the NASA language and various things about space flight that I didn't pick up going through school. And one thing led to another. I paid very close attention on what we had to know to be really good at what we did. And I got recognized for it. And before I knew it, I found myself running the place in the mission control room. And I always look back thinking, how did I luck into getting this cool job?
Well, so here's the thing that I would say is that everyone listening is saying, okay, well, there's a lot more than luck there. And so I think that, you know, we can all immediately feel like, well, hey, this guy is pretty smart. But listen, you did study aerospace engineering. It's not like, well, I'm working at McDonald's and now I'm at Mission Control. So maybe there is some luck involved and some blessings involved, I'm sure. But the reality is you had done a lot of the right kinds of things before you got to that point, right?
I definitely had done my homework, but I would say the thing that really served me the best was I was never afraid to look around the room at my peers, so say the people I shared offices with or in a meeting. And the people that when they spoke, they were like E.F. Hutton. Everybody listened to that guy or that woman, and boy, they always knew that person was right. And I made it my mission in life to find out, what is it that person's doing better than what I do? And what are the things they know that I don't know? What can I learn from them? And I was never shy about going right to them saying, hey, tutor me up. You know, I want to be better at what we do. And, you know, the NASA environment I grew up in, they rewarded you for that. And they took notice if you learned things and continued to become better and perform at a higher level.
Well, and that's what we would hope that organizations would do, right? If we've got folks who are diligent and disciplined and wanting to work hard, hopefully all of you leaders listening are thinking about doing that for your folks. So the first thing I said about you, Paul, when we started was that you call yourself a leadership evangelist. So tell us why that is and what you mean by that.
Okay, well, you know, it's related to the reason I wrote the book in the first place. And I'll come back to that, but essentially in the year or so before I retired from NASA and in the couple of years since, a number of people that I worked with back then, especially very high-placed executives, would ask me either, what are you going to do next? Or tell me what the hell it is you're doing again. Hmm. And I would tell them, and I would kind of struggle to put a name to it. And then I finally realized, no, this is what I'm doing, because there's a lot of executive coaches out there. In fact, I am associated with Marshall Goldsmith, who, you know, in my personal opinion, is the executive coach. And I'm in a group of people he selected. It's something he calls the MGU or the Marshall Goldsmith 100. But I don't profess to be a coach. There are certain strengths you need as a coach that I probably don't have, or maybe I say it differently. Some of the things that I am strongest in would probably make me an overbearing coach as opposed to a leader of people on the same team. But I did realize that in our experience in mission control, where we were failing wasn't in the control room flying the spaceship, doing the rocket science in the scary moments. It was managing the enterprise itself in things that didn't look like rocket science. And as heavily as we emphasize leadership in our organization, we practiced it almost nowhere in the management ranks. And we were failing as an organization. And about the time I got promoted into the senior management ranks, my predecessor as director had enough. He says, we're going to change this. And we did completely change it. And what surprised me looking back was, well, first, if we hadn't changed it when we had some things changed in NASA, that we would have failed as an organization and would have had to shut down doing mission control. And in fact, my opinion is we would have had to stop flying shuttle because my organization wouldn't have been able to keep doing it through the last shuttle flight. Right. But you put all that together and I realized my mission in life is telling people this. And in particular, telling people who are very successful and have been promoted up and put in charge, hey, here's how we were failing as a management team. And I would defy you to find a more successful, more respected organization than NASA's Mission Control. But we were failing as a management team, and we were causing our organization to fail. And that realization that we were able to turn that around, and in fact, that for years we had been oblivious to it, because we all knew, well, our big strength is leadership development. So how can we not be great leaders? Until we finally had to face up to it. So when you put all that together, I ended up realizing, okay, I am the evangelist of getting people's attention on this. Just because you've done well in the past, whether it's you individually or your organization, doesn't mean you're still doing things the right way. In fact, some of the way you've got to where you are might not be the right way. You might have gotten there in spite of doing things that were getting in your way. My job, if I do it well, will be to get senior managers' attention on that. How is it you might be leading your organization astray? How is it you might be leading your organization to fail? An otherwise very successful, very capable organization full of really talented people, how is it you might be unintentionally screwing that up? Because I'll tell you how we did it, and the book explains not only how we got there, but how we figured it out, how we wrestled with the uncomfortable part of changing it. So that's my short version of why I call myself an evangelist. Because if I can get an executive or a management team's attention on that, then there's all kinds of things they can do to turn it around. But somebody has to get their attention first, thus the evangelist.
There you go. So you've got our attention. You know, there's something in the book, and I, of course, I had no idea exactly how you were going to take that, answer that question. But the next thing I had to talk to you about, it's not just about you, but it's about NASA at large. There's a line in the book that I believe was one of the earlier NASA directors who said that the Apollo project was more of a management exercise than a technical one. And you've just been talking about the management and leadership aspects of mission control. I know that you weren't around for Apollo, right? But I'm really curious about your thoughts about that point, because all of us who aren't in that world, you know, go back and think about those of us old enough to remember Apollo and you know, my fellow Purdue alum, Neil Armstrong landing on the moon and all that stuff. But so you can be an Aggie, but I'm a Boilermaker. Fair enough.
Which was an A&M school?
I'm sorry?
It was an A&M school. It was established under the same act of Congress, the Morrill Act.
Yeah, the Land Grant Act. That's exactly right. So my question is, take us back as far as you can as it relates to that, because we'd think about this was all about figuring out how to build a rocket. But what you're saying is that we had most of the technical pieces largely. It was about figuring out how to make it all happen. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. Now, if you think about the very first Mercury mission, Alan Shepard gets on this little bitty rocket. When I say little bitty rocket, I mean 3 stories high, maybe. It's compared to the Saturn V and the shuttle, both of which were 10 times the size of a Mercury Redstone rocket. And on that Mercury Redstone rocket had that little engine on it, one little engine on it, was not even capable of making it into orbit. It threw Alan Shepard way up into space, in about 60 miles up in the sky, and then that falls down into the ocean off the coast of Florida. I mean, way out in the ocean, but still, right? So that happens in 1961. Fast forward then to 1969, and there's a rocket and a spacecraft that goes all the way to the moon, lands on the moon, and brings people back. Just the cost of a single flight from Mercury to Apollo changed by a factor of 70. And that's in normalized dollars. So if you compare same dollars, 70 times more costly for one mission. So again, if you think about that as a bean counter or as a manager versus as a rocket science guy, that alone is telling you that for each one opportunity, each time we try something in space, it now costs us 70 times more. And by the way, by the time we started flying shuttle, in the beginning, a shuttle flight ran about $500 million per flight. By the end, it was closer to $750 million per flight. So that point about it being more of a management exercise, well, there was definite rocket science that had to be done. The rockets had to be built the right way. But for the most part, that stuff was regular engineering. You know, 1 + 1 = 2. The rule, it follows the rule of physics. But when the organization grows that much, that fast, just keeping it all together and making sure that the guys building the engines are building them the way they fit in the rocket, and the structure that's in the rocket, it will actually hold the tanks, and the tanks are being built the right way to flow the fluid into the engine without everything blowing up. Huge, huge management exercise to get that all done. And of course, you know, as I was describing, you know, by the time we were a 40-year-old institution spread across 10 centers all across the country, mm-hmm. and not all of those centers, but least five of those centers had large direct roles in human spaceflight programs. So different pieces being managed out of different centers with thousands and thousands of contractors all over the country. Huge, huge management exercise to keep it all together. The rocket science in some ways was almost incidental because it is easier to follow. I mean, easier to do the rocket science because it is just the number crunching. It just, it follows the rules. The rest of it is managing.
There's a right way. In other words, there's a right way.
Yeah.
Right.
As opposed to managing relationships and teams of people and keeping them motivated and all aligned to the same mission. That's a much trickier problem.
I would agree 100%. So thanks for giving us that little extra piece. That leads me to a thought that wasn't in my list of questions, but you talked earlier about how mission control sort of was becoming, my words now, becoming sort of unsuccessful. And so what would you say were a couple of the reasons that got you from being very successful to less so before you guys were able to turn it around again? Like, what were a couple of things that led you to becoming more dysfunctional, to use another word?
Sure. I would say it's two things, and they were not unique to us. I mean, they're certainly prevalent everywhere else in NASA, and I would say they're prevalent in any team, especially the larger teams or larger companies. And an element of it is complacency, or as Marshall Goldsmith would call it, the paradox of success. We know we're good, and you think about who we are. We are the same mission control organization that planned and executed the missions that landed Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin on the moon. So by the time I come along, 20 years after that, and join this organization, think about the attitude in the rank and file as well as in the management. Hey, we don't have anything we need to listen to you about. You can't teach us anything. Do you know who we are? Do you know what my organization did? So that's part of it. And now we're no longer listening and learning from the outside. We've got tunnel vision. So that's part of it. And the other part is something I call the management cloud. You get promoted away from the real work, you know? So in our case, the rocket science and flying the rocket and mission control. But I would say this is the case in any business. You get promoted up and away from producing the product, and now you're managing infrastructure, you're managing people, you're managing these huge budgets and making sure you're coming in on budget at the end of the year. Doesn't really sound like the same problem. And if we make little mistakes, the rocket doesn't blow up. We didn't kill everybody because we made this mistake. And so it's easy to rationalize some of the goofier decisions that you make as a manager. And maybe there's some difficult decision you know you need to make. So somebody who's not performing that you need to move out of the way and bring up somebody that can manage or lead better. And you don't do it because it doesn't feel comfortable. I don't want to be confrontational. And you make a series of little decisions like that, and the management team as a whole starts performing at lower and lower levels. And in our case in particular, by the time I got into the management after my last flight as a flight director, the norm in the management team was a phrase called no ripples in the pond. The most senior managers are the people who are in charge of mission control. Their number one mantra, don't put any ripples in the pond, hold your cards close to the vest. And the way that played out then is if any part of the organization had some significant problem, they didn't
hide it.
They were expected to hide it. The boss expected them to not bring it up at the table in front of the rest of their peers or the senior management team because it might leak out. Somebody might find out we have a problem. It'll make it look like we're weak and we'll kind of get in trouble. Maybe they'll take budget away from us. And then you had these organizations within the mission control organization, these managers who were competing with each other like they were competing business units. The one product that we had was planning missions and flying them for mission control and protecting astronauts. And yet these saw themselves as competition because, you know, if one of them got five extra people this year, then that's five extra people that this other organization didn't get. Craziness. And those types of evolutions as managers happen to in any business, in any industry. The trick is realizing you've done that before it's too late and you've led the organization into failure. And of course, one of the reasons why we became so hypersensitive about this is it's that same kind of phenomena that led NASA at a higher level to manage in awful ways and led to the Apollo 1 accident in 1967, Challenger in 1986, and Columbia in 2003, all three of which were avoidable failures. In fact, in the two shuttle cases, they weren't just avoidable, but they were people in the community who knew that we were doing some dumb things without enough technical rigor. And the biggest reason we were doing it is, hey guys, this is who we are. We know we're good at this. We can take this risk. We've gotten away with it before, so it must be okay to do.
Yeah, you know, I think it's interesting to me, Paul, as I listen and as everyone else is listening, that while no one else listening probably is involved at NASA, or very few, the reality is that we can all recognize what you're saying. Maybe we haven't had the signature successes, if you would, that NASA has had, but that idea of we're invincible, of we're smart or smart enough, we're smarter than everybody else, that puffed out chest sort of issue, that Marshall's paradox of success is really a challenge that all of us have to be aware of, not just for ourselves and our peers, but for our teams that we're leading as well. We got to make sure that we're not leading them down that path either. So you also had a very critical, you just talked about some of the mistakes, the big mistakes. Now we're not just talking about ripples in the pond, we're talking about things that everybody obviously found out about, knew about, and specifically the Columbia accident. And you had a significant role after that leading up to the next shuttle flight. Can you talk just a little bit about the size of that challenge in the context of the organization that you just described?
Sure. Well, you know, immediately after the accident, of course, the mood in our community, when I say our community, I mean the human spaceflight community within NASA and all of the prime contractors that supported us. But the general mood at first was, first, holy cow, we failed these guys, because these seven people that died were friends of ours. So that's number one. So there's this immense grieving, and at the same time, immense fear that now we're not ever going to fly again. Because after Challenger, the notion was always kind of accepted that we can't have another accident. Next, if we have another accident, then the country's not going to trust us to keep doing this. So we had both of those happening at the same time. And then I was put in charge of a team of engineers that was investigating how we would detect damage and then repair it in flight if we were to do that to another orbit, which was not an opportunity or not an option on this flight. And it had been studied back in the late 70s, and NASA had formally declared that problem to be impossible, that you're just going to have to accept this as a risk, and if it happens, there's no way to repair it. And at the same time, I was told, if you can't solve this, then we may not ever fly again. Go.
So go solve the impossible.
Right.
And do it in, what was it, 6 months?
Yeah, well, they did ask us to do it in 6 months. The ridiculous intent from the senior management in February, so less than a month after the Columbia accident, was that we were going to fly 6 months later, which was ridiculous. It was 2.5 years later when we flew. Somewhere at least 2 years would have been a more reasonable estimate or target for us from the get-go. But, you know, I would say there was an element of that the senior managers expected my team to go study it and to come back and confirm how impossible the problem was to solve in the first place. And instead, we picked up where that study left off 30 years before, 20 years before, and took their failings. Like, here's why each part of this is impossible. And we attacked that. So now, how do we change that? What is it about that caused it not to work? And what would we do differently to now make that possible? And in between 3 and 5 months, we had almost all parts of the problem solved. But we didn't do it all as one giant problem. We looked at each part of the problem separately, and we had individual teams looking at each facet. Because if you take each facet and make it possible, all of a sudden the really big impossible thing was no longer impossible. It was just kind of hard. And 2 years later, after we had pulled all these answers together, we had manufactured all this equipment, trained the astronauts in new procedures for inspecting for damage and repairing damage, and we flew them on that very next flight and tested them in orbit, and they all worked tremendously. But it was a solid 2.5 year effort. I mean, you know, we had to get through the accident investigation while we were doing this in parallel. And then we had plowing through developing all this new material. And, you know, as you can imagine, you go from an engineering study where we say, hey, we've had these results in the lab. This is now how we'll solve the problem. And then we spent a good year and a half after that fighting about how do you turn that into something you really bet the astronauts' lives on and put on board. And it was a slog, but we got there. It was the hardest 2 years of my life.
Oh, I can imagine that. I want to just take everybody back in. I'm sure that everyone listening is like me and just sort of really interested in the story. And that's one of the reasons, Paul, honestly, that I wanted to have you on. But you said something really important in there about the idea of you didn't try to tackle the problem altogether. You pulled it apart into separate, smaller problems. And I think, again, even though we're not solving shuttle level problems in terms of complexity or impact perhaps, but I think that there's a tremendous amount of wisdom for all of us in that particular point. So Paul, I have something that I do every single time that I have a guest on, excuse me. And what I have is 4 words that I'm going to share with you. I'm going to share a word. I just want you to give me your first reaction, your initial thoughts to that word or that idea. And there's no wrong answers. Are you ready?
Sure.
Okay, the first word is empowerment.
Empowerment. The first thing I think of is trust your people to do the right thing.
Okay. Well, how about the next word? It's on the list. I'll just move it up. Trust.
Trust but verified. A trust but earned. You absolutely have to trust your people, but you don't trust them blindly. You make sure that they are doing the math the right way. They're making the right decisions for the right reasons. And you don't do that just by checking up on them. You have to have an ongoing two-way dialogue. Here's what we think is right. Here's what we think is wrong. We all agree to this, right? I mean, tell me if you think I'm getting some of this wrong. But when we agree to this, I'm going to hold you to it. But all right, as long as we are executing that way, I give you absolute trust.
All right. Next word on my list is mission.
Mission. Mission is the thing that we exist to do. So whatever our own little parochial desires are, you know, competing my part of the company off against that, but some other part of the company, none of that matters. The mission is what we're here for. Get it done. Whatever the product is that the company exists to do, or the service we provide, the next mission that we are doing in space, that should be the thing that we are aligning all of our decisions to. And anything else we're letting creeping in, or we let creep into our decision making, is going to hurt performance for the team. It's going to hurt our ability to perform the mission.
And the last word I have for you is training.
Training. You know, training's an interesting one. A lot of people think training is just teaching somebody how to do the math, or when you get this stimulus, you give this response. For my experience, certainly in mission control, but I think this is true as a manager, the more important training is that deliberately articulating, here's what we exist to do, and here's how we decide what right and wrong are. And if we can all agree to that, you can take just about any team and solve just about any problem. Because, you know, as I said when we started, you can learn the math and the engineering, but if you're not all aligned on what the mission is, and if some of us are holding cards close to the vest and making decisions for reasons that are different than the rest, we're not all pushing the same way. We're not going to solve the impossible problems. We are likely going to trip on the easy problems that we used to be able to do well.
All right. So you spent all this time getting people into space and getting them back and all that stuff. And you talked about certainly in that one project, the toughest 2 years of your life. But everyone on this earth, I hope, and I hope this is true for you, I believe it probably is, do something for fun. So what's something now, maybe now that you are no longer at NASA, retired from NASA, what's something that, Paul, that you do for fun?
You know, I travel with my family, even though my daughters are both adults and, you know, live on their own. But one of the things I enjoy most is traveling with them, you know, the 4 of us together. And actually, one of the real heartwarming things for me as a dad with adult children is that both of my adult daughters still like spending time with us and traveling with us. So that's
There you go. Like, not only do you like it, but they like it too. That makes it a lot better, right?
And importantly, not just when I'm paying.
Well, even better. Even better. So, Paul, what is it that you are reading or have read recently that you might share with everybody?
You know, I'm reading another Marshall Goldsmith book, his book Triggers. Just like his book What Got You Here Won't Get You There, I find it a great book.
Right. Everybody, earlier Paul mentioned that he is one of the Marshall Goldsmith 100, one of those coaches. And there's at least, I know for sure, that there's one other past guest who is among that 100. There may be others, but I know for sure there is one other. That's Michael Bungay Stanier. So if you haven't listened to the Michael Bungay Stanier episode about coaching, you really ought to go do it. He's one of the smartest guys around. So, Paul, the most important question, probably the one you've been wanting me to ask, is, okay, where can we learn more about your work and the book and all of that? So, again, the book is titled Leadership from the Mission Control Room to the Boardroom. Tell us where we can learn more about the book and your work.
Okay. Let's see. The book is available online in the U.S. and Canada today. You know, I'm at places like Amazon, Barnes & Nobles, you name it, in hardcover, softcover, and an ebook. And Nicholas Breeley is coming out with an international edition that they're going to distribute worldwide starting in the UK in January. And that book will be titled Mission Control Management.
There you go. So if you're not listening from the US or Canada, you can get the book, and it's titled Mission Control Management. And by the time this comes out, it will be available, or very soon will be available. So, and where can we learn more about you, yourself? Tell us about your website, etc. Paul?
My website is atlasexec.com. So the word atlas and then exec.com. And it will tell you all about the book, all about my leadership speaking and workshops that I offer on the same material.
All right. We had a little trouble with audio right there, but I think we got it all. So Paul, thanks so much. But listen, before we go, everybody, question for you. As always, now what? What are you going to do with what you just got? This episode, maybe as much as any, is one where you might have been enthralled with the story, but don't lose sight of the lessons. I tried to stop and pull a few out for you along the way, but questions for you like, have you developed tunnel vision, you or your team? Are you living in a management cloud, to use one of the words, phrases that Paul mentioned? And how are you doing problem solving, and what insights can you take from today for the problem solving that you're doing personally and with your team? So again, our challenge here always is to say, how can I use what I learned, not just be entertained, although hopefully you were, but to ask the question, now what? I hope you'll do exactly that. So Paul, thanks so much for joining us. It's been an absolute pleasure to have you. I enjoyed it a great deal.
Thanks for having me, Kevin.
All right. So everybody, if you enjoyed this, you know, there's a lot more. There's plenty more episodes for you to listen to. Go wherever you found this one and find some more. And if you want to join the conversation and get updates and have a hand in how we build this podcast and evolve it over time, you can do that by joining our Facebook group. Just go to remarkablepodcast.com/Facebook. And now, until the next time we're together, I wish you a remarkable day. Thanks again, Paul, for being here. And everybody, we'll see you on the next episode of the Remarkable Leadership Podcast. Mm-hmm.